Welcome to Fraud Talk. I'm Cora Bullock, assistant editor of Fraud Magazine, and today we have Martin Beagleman, executive vice president of IPSA International in their Phoenix office. IPSA International is a global risk advisory firm in the areas of anti-money laundering, anti-bribery and corruption, investigative due diligence, and litigation support. Today he will be talking to us about a massive insurance fraud that had run for decades and cost insurers millions of dollars that he investigated in New York City. Some names have been changed. So welcome, Martin.
Hi, Cora.
So can you give a brief explanation of New York public adjusters and insurance company adjusters and how their relationship defined this case?
It's my pleasure. This was a very special case for me. In fact, it would make great fiction because it's really hard to believe that it was true, but it was. It was a true story about a way of life in New York where corruption, kickbacks, fraud and deceit were everyday occurrences and a life that the perpetrators, the fraudsters, thought would never end. And it probably wouldn't have ended if it wasn't for some real strong detective work, persistence and dedication, as well as some very good luck. For many years, a conspiracy existed in practically every segment of the New York insurance industry to fraudulently inflate and stage property claims and collect the proceeds. And the claims were both for homeowner insurance claims and commercial claims. What we found was the corruption was so pervasive that almost everyone involved in the claims process was in on the fraud. And that included everybody from the homeowner or the commercial insured to the public adjuster, to the company adjuster, to the brokers, the salvage people, the accountants and lawyers and others involved. And what we found that huge under-the-table payoffs and kickbacks, as well as a strict code of silence, kept this conspiracy going for 40 years. And that was an amazing amount of time for a conspiracy. Now, for people who are not familiar with public adjusters, that public adjusters are licensed professionals who adjust property claims on behalf of insured property owners. They typically work with insurance companies and the insurance adjusters for those companies and other experts to determine settlement amounts. And then, of course, there's money paid as commissions to the public adjusters and then passed on to the insureds. Now, this particular scheme involved kickbacks paid by the public adjusters to the insurance company adjusters and other experts to convince them to go along with the conspiracy and either stage claims, which were just totally fraudulent, non-existent claims, or legitimate claims that they would fraudulently inflate to get extra money for the payoffs. There were literally millions of dollars shared among the fraudsters. We found thousands and thousands of phony claims that were staged and inflated, and was interesting, some were as low as 8,000 up to an astonishing $19 million claim.
Wow.
That was absolutely not only fraudulent, but it was staged from the get-go. There was absolutely no damage, and everything involved was staged for the fraud. We found that claims included everything from water damage, vandalism, burglary, fire, and in a few instances, arson. But the fraudsters were imaginative in their work, and that's what made it so successful. The investigation found that the fraudsters actually constructed machines to blow powdered charcoal into buildings to simulate smoke damage, that they actually installed pipes in buildings for the sole purpose of breaking them to create water damage claims. They even took tea and sprayed it on the walls to look like water stain damage. We ultimately uncovered over $500 million of fraudulent insurance claims.
That's incredible. That's incredible. So let's start at the beginning. You became involved with this case while you were a U.S. Postal Inspector in New York City, thanks to an insurance fraud investigator named Art Harding. What about the case interested you?
Art Harding was an exceptional New York police detective who, upon his retirement, became an insurance fraud investigator for the Insurance Crime Prevention Institute. Now, I worked with Art investigating insurance fraud for many years and did a lot of little cases. And as we worked together, Art told me that there was a loosely knit conspiracy going back about 40 years that existed in the New York metropolitan area and involved all the participants in the property claim settlement. It really got my interest, and I would ask him more and more about it. And he said he learned about this from various informants over the years. Now, Art said that the fraud was so pervasive and that it involved everyone in the claims process, and that because of that, and because there had never been a large-scale, successful investigation of the industry, no one had been able to crack the criminal chain, and no one got any of the fraudsters to talk, and it just continued on and on. Art decided that I was the one to take on this monumental task.
Lucky you.
And I was up for the challenge. My first question to Art is, you know, what evidence do you have so that we can begin the investigation? You know, what information do you have? And he looked me in the eye and he said, well, boyo, that's the problem. I don't have any tangible evidence, but I have all the faith in the world that you'll be able to find and discover what we need to make the case. I like challenges, but this one had impossible written all over it. I mean, it's great to have a case, but where do you start? And first of all, where's the evidence? There was just supposition and innuendo and rumor about this large-scale conspiracy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just when I was about to lose hope, lightning struck. An investigator with a major insurance company called me and told me of several anonymous phone calls they recently received. One anonymous caller alleged that a company adjuster was involved in fraudulent claims and was receiving large amounts of payoffs. Another caller described a person who was at his country club on Long Island, and while the country club was bragging to other members of the country club that he was engaged in a number of claims, was making lots of money on insurance claims, and was using a public adjuster at that same country club. Mm-hmm. And after that, I decided we had enough information to commence our investigation and start collecting evidence, and I started a task force investigation.
Is there one claim in particular that caught your eye?
We actually started work on the case in 1990, and once we had the anonymous phone calls, we started collecting claim files on both that claims adjuster from the insurance company as well as the public adjuster, and started going through them. And as we went through the files, and they really caught us because of the red flags, and the Jimmy Collier claim file was one good example. Collier and his wife lived in an apartment in Queens, New York. Collier filed an insurance claim with his insurance company alleging severe water damage in his apartment. What he said happened, at least in the claim file, was that his wife was washing dishes. Somehow she forgot to turn the water off. Somehow a dish rag fell into the sink, clogging the drain, causing the water to overflow. They left the apartment for some period of time, and apparently what they wanted the insurance company to believe was that the entire apartment was flooded, including all the contents, the furniture, clothing, even in closets on the other side of the house. When we looked at the claim file, and it was paid within days of occurrence, was that the pictures in the claim file didn't substantiate the detailed damage that was in the written report. Now, a lot of the damage was, again, furniture and personal possessions. What we found interesting is that Collier lived on the sixth floor of an apartment building. And although the water was left running for many hours, we were unaware of any potential damage to the apartments next door or below. And we came to this interesting belief. Collier wanted the insurance company to believe that although the water filled his apartment to the ceiling, destroying all the evidence, destroying all the furniture, the clothes, and other contents, no water escaped next door or below. In fact, we used to joke that Collier wanted us to believe that he didn't live in Queens. He really lived in Toontown. We started seeing the marriage of corrupt company adjusters and public adjusters, and one of our suspect adjusters, including the one where the phone call came in from to the insurance company, was the company adjuster on this claim. So with the evidence that we had from the claim file, we decided to go interview Mr. Collier, and we went to his apartment. Well, mm-hmm. to our surprise, when we got there, we found out that he had moved, and he had moved to a house on Long Island. But, you know, it's also a good example about you really have to stay focused. And rather than just leave after the current tenant said that the Colliers had moved, I asked the tenants, would you mind if we came in and examined your apartment? Of course, we identified ourselves. And what our purpose was that if indeed there was this significant amount of water damage, I would have expected to find evidence of water damage. And with their permission, we actually pulled up the carpets in the corners of the rooms. And the floors underneath were wood floors, unfinished wood floors. No damage, no evidence of water damage at all. Mm-hmm. The walls were sheetrock, and And as we know from water damage claims, sheet rocks will really show a significant damage, especially from water. No evidence of that. But we went further. We spoke to the super. We spoke to the landlord. We spoke to people who lived below this apartment on the sixth floor. No one had any evidence or any information that ever was a water damage claim. So we decided to do something unique. With the evidence we had, we went to a federal judge, and we said we would like to get a search warrant for the Collier home, which is now on Long Island, to seize any of the furniture and other items that were described and pictured in the photographs, because the photographs did not show any evidence of damage, although the report said it did. Well, when the judge read our search warrant, the judge said, "Now I've seen everything." But the evidence was compelling enough to get a search warrant, and probable cause was there, and we got a search warrant. Now, you can imagine Collier's surprise when we showed up at his residence with a moving van and a search warrant allowing us to go into his residence and search. And we did. We found many of the pieces of the furniture that he had claimed were totally damaged several years before. We seized that pursuant to the search warrant, and I sent it to the Postal Inspection Service Crime Lab. That lab came back and found no evidence of water damage, no evidence of refinishing or reupholstery. In fact, there was no evidence that the furniture had been in any way damaged by water. With that evidence, we were able to indict him, arrest him, and he quickly flipped and agreed to cooperate. And what's really even very interesting, it really made this very pointed, is that Collier was a salvage expert who worked in the insurance industry, working with public adjusters and company adjusters in the claims process. And when he flipped, you can imagine the amount of information he provided us that really, at that early stage, helped us advance the investigation.
So you wrote that in the casebook, enormity and long time frame of the conspiracy benefited the fraud examiners. So I would think that it would be the opposite. So tell us exactly how that benefited.
We believe that because this conspiracy went on for so many decades, that it would help us get the evidence, obtain the evidence, and solve the case. Now, because it went on for so long and there were so many insurance claims and so many defendants, we found an abundance of evidence. Now, while it might be possible for a defendant to fight criminal charges on one or two acts of fraud and corruption, it was impossible when one committed dozens, if not hundreds, of such crimes over a many-year period. Once you start eating potato chips, you can't stop. Same with these fraud schemes. Because no one ever successfully investigated it, these people, these fraudsters, did dozens and dozens and dozens. And so when you have a case with so strong and compelling evidence, defendants are less likely to go to trial and prevail. In fact, we had defendants literally running to the U.S. Attorney's Office to get plea and cooperation deals to lessen their exposure. And in fact, case after case, we had so many conspirators pleading guilty and cooperating, it made it impossible for a lone defendant to prevail at trial.
So that's why only two individuals went to trial and were convicted.
Absolutely. Okay. And, you know, when the evidence, and we made sure to publicize the case and the evidence and sit down with potential subjects of investigations and their counsel to lay out the evidence. And because we had, you know, literally hundreds of claim files where individuals were involved in taking bribes, taking kickbacks, and committing fraud, the amount of time they might do under the federal sentencing guidelines made it critical for them to accept pleas and accept responsibilities of their actions in hopes that they would get a lesser sentence.
Please tell us the top lessons that you and your team learned from this case.
We realized in order to investigate fraud in the insurance business and the insurance industry, we needed to know both the business and the industry. But that included for us education, how the business worked, how insurance claims were filed and paid, the roles of the various participants in the claims process, and the terminology and the lingo. So when we went through the claim files, we knew exactly what to look for. Now, we needed to use every available tool in the fraud examiner's toolkit. That included undercover operations, physical and electronic surveillance, search warrants, subpoenas, flipping defendants into cooperators, publicizing indictments and arrests, as well as adding tax evasion charges for the unreported cash payoffs. In fact, defendants told us that they feared the tax evasion charges more than almost anything. But something else was reinforced for us. Know your case, know your investigation inside and out. We found it extremely beneficial to constantly review our notes and reports, as well as the key evidence we found, with hundreds of defendants and witnesses and associated notes and a large volume of evidence that took up a whole floor of a federal office building. There was always something discovered or remembered when we went back again and again and again. We also found, as I said before, we also found that by having a small number of investigators who stayed together for most of the investigation, who knew the evidence, who knew the defendants, who knew the subjects, we retained historical knowledge of the case, and that was a key advantage for us.
Okay. How long was the investigation, and was any money recovered?
The case started in 1990, and it continued really until the late 90s.
Wow.
Now, what happened was because of the thousands and thousands of fraudulent claims and about over $500 million in fraud, once we did our cases and once we obtained convictions of fraudsters, the insurance companies would take civil action against the defendants and obtain money coming back. In fact, we had forfeiture actions, we had restitution offers and requirements, and usually in most of the convictions, the court would order restitution to be paid to the insurance companies. But in the civil actions that the insurance companies filed through their outside counsel, they were able to recover millions of dollars.
In your opinion, how could the insurance companies have prevented this massive fraud?
First, they should have understood the fraud risk. We found that management at the victim companies had no idea that the corruption and fraud was going on. And those involved in the insurance industry must be aware that insurance fraud is a constant threat that results in billions of dollars in losses every year. We found that management of every organization needs to perform an ongoing fraud risk assessment and take appropriate action to mitigate those identified risks. That being said, today's insurance companies, I would say, are laser-focused on fraud detection and prevention. Another area is rotation of employees. The conspiracy that we investigated was successful for so long because the same company adjusters were allowed to work the same territories and with the same public adjusters and other external personnel for year after year after year. Had these adjusters been rotated, the fraud marriages, as we call them, may have been broken up. Another area was to listen and respond to rumors. Throughout the investigation, we learned that there were numerous rumors of unexplained wealth and extravagant lifestyles on the part of the company adjusters. Now, in many cases, it was evident that the adjusters were living well beyond their means, but no one in management did anything about it. We always say that rumors and other questionable activity must be appropriately acted on and professionally investigated. Another area was to review the claim files. One of the constants that we found was a lack of a thorough review of claim files by insurance company claims representatives and second-level and higher-level review. We always would say that the claim representatives needed to be trained in detection of fraud and red flags. Had there been that consistent and effective review process, the companies would have discovered the same red flags that we found that were just glaring at us from the claim files we reviewed. Another area that really was a great prevention tool that should have been used is ethics and fraud awareness training. The victim companies generally did not provide either ethics or fraud awareness training to their employees at the time. And we felt this was a critical lapse that contributed to the culture of fraud. We know that ethical conduct and fraud prevention training is needed on at least an annual basis for all employees. In fact, it's highly recommended that all employees be told whenever any employer or others doing business with the company are charged with a crime and charged for fraudulent activity and convicted of fraudulent activity. This demonstrates to employees and customers and others that organizations take a strong stand against fraud and abuse, and it also goes to tone at the top. Another area we found missing at the time was hotlines. The anonymous calls that fueled this case did not come through a formal hotline. Instead, they were received ad hoc by insurance company employees. In fact, most of the victim companies, and the victim companies at the time were every major insurance company in the U.S., that these victim companies did not have hotlines in place. all companies should institute hotlines to allow for anonymous and confidential reporting of allegations of fraud and violations of policy and other misconduct. I also believe that hotlines must be widely communicated internally and externally. I like to say, if you build it right, they will call. And that should be the organizational mantra. Most important, all allegations received must be thoroughly vetted and investigated. And last but not least in any way is the use of certified fraud investigators. Today, with certified fraud examiner certification as the gold standard for fraud detection and prevention, organizations are better served and protected by having CFEs on their investigative staff. Every investigative unit at every organization must have CFEs to detect, investigate, and prevent fraud. Fraud examination expertise is absolutely critical in fostering a climate of honesty and integrity in every organization. And I have no doubt that if CFEs were in place in these insurance companies, in their special investigative units and fraud investigation units at the time, this conspiracy would never have existed for as long as it did, and it definitely would have not have defrauded such large amounts, such billions of dollars from the organizations.
Thank you, Martin, for your thorough analysis of your examination. You can read more cases in Fraud Casebook, Lessons from the Bad Side of Business, available at acfe.com. Thanks for listening to Fraud Talk. You can find all of our fraud talks at acfe.com/podcast.
Of policy and other misconduct. I also believe that hotlines must be widely communicated internally and externally. I like to say, if you build it right, they will call. And that should be the organizational mantra. Most important, all allegations received must be thoroughly vetted and investigated. And last but not least in any way is the use of certified fraud investigators. Today, with certified fraud examiner certification as the gold standard for fraud detection and prevention, organizations are better served and protected by having CFEs on their investigative staff. Every investigative unit at every organization must have CFEs to detect, investigate, and prevent fraud. Fraud examination expertise is absolutely critical in fostering a climate of honesty and integrity in every organization. And I have no doubt that if CFEs were in place in these insurance companies, in their special investigative units and fraud investigation units at the time, this conspiracy would never have existed for as long as it did, and it definitely would have not have defrauded such large amounts, such billions of dollars from the organizations.